A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This podcast is a Roifield Brown production. Find others on iTunes.
All right. Yeah, I know.
Ladies and gentlemen, please remain standing for the singing of our national anthem.
Brexit means Brexit.
My administration has accomplished more than almost any administration in the history of our country.
Hello and welcome to Mid-Atlantic, the show where we look at the news and the views from one side of the Atlantic from the perspective of the other. I am Royfield Brown, who's back home with my folks in Birmingham in England. Today we are joined by TV pundit Laura Babcock in Hamilton in Canada, journalist Emma Burnell, who's in London in England, and by author Jared Kobeck in Los Angeles in America. Say hello, folks.
Hi, folks. Hey.
In a week that has seen 16 Formula One drivers take a knee for Black Lives Matter, we ask, is the Supreme Court the effective check on the Trump administration that the Republican Party has not been?
We have breaking news from the Supreme Court, and this has the potential to impact at least the political standing of the president and possibly the presidential race. The justices have just ruled against the president's attempts to shield his financial records and tax documents from New York prosecutors. NBC Justice correspondent Pete Williams is with us to explain.
So the president must turn over his taxes to the grand jury in New York unless he can come up with the same kind of arguments that any other person would be able to raise as an objection in court. So the Supreme Court sent the Vance case, the New York grand jury case, back to the lower courts, but it took away all the arguments the president made about why he is different and special, that he's absolutely immune from the criminal justice process, and that allowing local district attorneys to seek things from the president would subject a president to harassment. So what the Supreme Court says is, okay, now go back to court and make the same kind of arguments anybody else would make about why you think these subpoenas are intrusive.
At his campaign rally last month in Tulsa, President Trump said his Supreme Court appointments were some of his biggest achievements. We have two justices of the Supreme Court, Justice Gorsuch and Justice Kavanaugh. After last week's rulings, was that a hollow boast from Trump? Well, how about you, Jared? What do you reckon?
I have a complicated idea about this, which is, I think in many of the rulings, the answer is no. In some of the rulings, the answer is yes. I think we think about the Supreme Court as this abstract entity, which is made up of nine nameless figures, or not nameless, but just like, I don't know how you describe them, nine abstract figures, but they're actually individuals. And I think the fact that they all have to live in DC means there's a certain kind of socialization that happens in Georgetown, that happens in the corridors of power. And I think, you know, if you want to go to good parties in Georgetown, if you're John Roberts, you cannot side with Trump. And I think that's been the guiding philosophy. It has certainly been a check on the imperial presidency. I don't think it's been a check on individual policy issues.
But isn't the whole construct of the Supreme Court to be that these actually are individuals and it's their interpretation of the law, of the Constitution? But then also, doesn't this really underline the fact that Roberts is supposed to be the conservative and he has sided with the liberals at least on three occasions in the last year? That one of the things which he's really conscious about, Justice Roberts, is the place and the standing actually of the Supreme Court. And he doesn't want it to be this divisive political cudgel in the middle of the American debate. Emma.
I think what's really interesting about the appointees to the Supreme Court is that they're conservative, they're not Trumpist. And that's what we're seeing is actually there's a big division between conservatism and Trumpism. And so they are saying quite often in these rulings, we don't hate what you're trying to do, but the way you're doing it is so wrong that it's impossible for us to let you go get away with it. You know, it's so against our constitution. It's so against all the rules we set for ourselves. So I think that what they are saying a lot of the time is not you have the wrong ideas, you're taking the wrong approach, but we want to be conservative, you're trying to make us radical, and we don't want to be radical.
And I think it's also a little oversimplistic when people select the Supreme Court, the idea that, oh, they are selected by this president or they belong to this party. These are people who are highly intelligent, who have a historic responsibility, who, you know, take jurisprudence extremely seriously. And in a time when we're seeing the democracy, the foundations of American democracy crumble, I think the role of the Supreme Court has never been more important. And we're seeing that kind of judgment come out of it. Whether or not Trump thinks they're against him or for him, or whether or not people think that they're acting like conservative judges or Republican judges, I think they're acting like judges. And we won't like all of the rulings, but we're going to see, I think, a kind of level of sobriety that is going to come out of the bench. Less rhetoric, less nonsense, more of a really serious attempt to keep their third of what is America up, right? They are responsible for a full third of it. And they have to, the third branch of government, they've got to sustain it. And I think we're watching some really remarkable rulings.
Gerald, have they convinced you? Do you still believe this is because, you know, Roberts likes to go to these Georgetown cocktail parties, and that's the reason why he's not signed up to the whole Trump bandwagon?
I think they're the same thing, to be honest, which is I think the Supreme Court justices exist in a social milieu which is determined by a series of socially agreed upon norms, and that they're reflective of those norms. It may be that around DC, in Georgetown, in Virginia, that's the place where the norms of government are the most believed in the entire country, right? Because that's an entire ecosystem that exists in the shadow of the idea of the federal government, of the idea of the federal government being responsible, right? So I don't think it's disconsonant. I mean, I agree with both of those points of views. I just also think I have a really dubious view of human nature.
That's because I'm 45 and I've been dating for a long time.
as your neighbor watching what's happening to the south of us, I'm optimistic that maybe there is an awareness of the adults have got to start taking charge, right? Because the whole world is quite concerned.
I don't know. I think in 2016, we all said, this is the worst year. Nothing could be worse than this. Every year that's come since has really done its absolute best to convince us otherwise.
Amen to that, sister. And we're only halfway through 2020, and it's by far the worst year since at least 1945. On Thursday, the Supreme Court categorically dismissed President Trump's claim to absolute immunity against investigators seeking his tax returns. This is obviously a bloody nose. Will it have any political consequence, Jared?
What do you mean by political consequence?
Oh, Trump could maybe filibuster this out until after the election.
Yeah, will we get any view of those tax returns before November?
No, I don't think so.
Well, will this provide some kind of cover for those Republicans who are running for Congress and for Senate? More importantly, the Senate, really, because Congress is almost definitely going to be returned blue. In November, you know, it's a case of the Supreme Court, which is our Supreme Court, if you are a right winger, as legislated against the put a decision against the president. They know they're going down for a historic defeat. Will this stiffen their sinews? Will it stiffen the backs of those Republican senators who are running in swing states so that they can actually come out and say that this president is not fit for the office?
Probably. I mean, I think it depends more on what the polling looks like. Whether or not this individual decision will affect that, I have a very dubious view of human nature. I think it's not enough. I think it might be the beginning of people getting to that point, particularly as they become more terrified about their own position.
Yeah, but we see people flipping over to the sort of anti-Trump stance once they've got through their primaries. Do you think that's what's more likely to happen?
Possibly. I find what Republicans have done mystifying, and I find the conversion of that political party into, you know, I mean, probably these are changeable people. I mean, one of the things that really was incredible after Trump won was how it was a party of people who were basically either vocally or tacitly opposed to his election.
Yeah.
Once he won, they all came and kissed the ring. I mean, he actually ran like some kind of auditions for people where like Mitt Romney showed up and wore a lobster bib. I think they easily could change. I don't think they have loyalty to Trump. I think they have loyalty to the idea of winning. And if he
but
seems like
power, loyalty to power rather than loyalty to who's in power.
Yeah.
But are they not, are they not also enthralled to the power of the Georgetown cocktail set as well? You know, these senators.
The senators, the House, less.
The justices are more plallable and malleable than the senators.
Say that again. I'm sorry, I missed. I think I actually talked over you.
Why is it that the justices, if I'm going by your distrust of human nature, right, and the fact that Roberts in particular, the centrist justice, can, you know, he wants to get on with the Georgetown set, okay? So why is it that the senators who also live in Washington are not so malleable and pliable in terms of their attitude towards Trump so far?
I think because for quite a while, it looked like Trump was the key to winning, right? With the base at the very least. Supreme Court judges that's a lifetime appointment. They're immediately removed from that ecosystem. And I think there is a ton of institutional drift. People have done work on this idea that there may really be a liberal drift just by virtue of being part of the court. And also, you know, the position of senator is a really strange position. The Senate was established kind of to give, you know, to create almost, 100 individual fiefdoms. That's different than being a justice. And also, I think, as someone just said, you know, these are, whatever you want to say about them in terms of their political leanings, these are serious people in a very different way than politicians can be serious people. These are people who have, you would hope, a lot of interaction with the law. They've been scholars. You don't end up there without some kind of rationality and debate happening. And I think that, you know, I think that's a very different mindset than just getting the power of being a senator.
Emma?
I mean, that yes, but I mean, you know, 2 years ago, we were watching Brett Kavanaugh behave like a spoiled teenager in his confirmation hearing.
Yeah.
So.
But he's a weird one.
He is a weird one, but then,
He's like something that was grown in a tank.
Groped women. There is a weird one in all of their pasts, or at least quite a few of their pasts.
Yeah.
But okay, if we go to the senators for a second, what I think is really interesting is, and you mentioned the polling, obviously Trump's in big trouble. If you look at the polling, we're 4 months out. We all learned our lesson last time. Let's not put too much on the poll. What I think runs America and always has is money. And if you look at the fundraising that is happening in some of these Senate races up again, they are trying to take out the big dogs. They are going after Lindsey Graham. They are going after these previously untouchable senators to try to take the power back in the Senate. There will be no kind of advancement if it remains where the Senate is so controlled by the GOP. So there has to be taking out these big ones. And some of the numbers in those races, not just the fundraising, but the polling locally, are really astounding. And it goes to, I think, you know, it's easy for us to think, I believe, certainly, I'm cynical like you are, what is Trump willing to do? He just commuted Stone's sentence. There's nothing he won't do to win. There's nothing he won't do between losing and January 20th to make everyone pay for him losing. I mean, we are in for a rocky 6 months, no doubt about it. But I also look at the midterm results and the enthusiasm levels against Trump, not for Biden, but against Trump, and the fact that they were able to turn so many smaller seats. So I have more confidence in the bigger play that's going on by the Democrats, by 20 million people being part of Black Lives Matters protests. If those people are going to vote against Trump for the only safe alternative, Biden, I mean, I just think that there is a possibility here for a shift in November that will be substantial. And I'm hoping it goes all down ticket.
The most obvious seats that the Democrats are going to take from Republicans are the ones where you have people who are normally known as soft Republicans. So Susan Collins, for example. Now, okay, Susan Collins lets us down a lot. A lot.
All the time. She always promises and never delivers, don't she?
I never listen to her. I can't stand people like that.
Surely very ideological Republican Party in the seats where they're never going to lose. And a Democratic Party that's actually very diverse and doesn't hang together that well. That's going to be an interesting challenge for the Democrats, I think.
Let's go back, because we've had a little bit of topic drift here. Let's drag it all the way back. You in particular, Emma, in the last year, we've seen rulings not necessarily go the way that people thought they would ideologically because of the split of the court. Okay? LGBTQ rights have been strengthened, DACA is still there, etc., etc. Has the Supreme Court really cemented itself as this body which isn't necessarily party political, the way it was supposed to have been? Has Roberts been correct in that this is not a party political organ of state, and has he safeguarded it from those accusations? Mr. K.
For the time being, I think that's what he has tried to do. He has been the deciding vote in almost all of the decisions that would give that impression. I mean, to talk about it being cemented, it's a changeable body. There's a lot of very people of advanced age on that thing. That court could change tomorrow, right? And if it did change tomorrow, if Trump, Trump is still president, it would be this discussion would be very different. And I mean, I think that's one of the things about the court that's, you know, hard to talk about.
Remember when Anton Scalia died in 2016, 2016, Mitch McConnell says you can't have a new justice in an election year. So right. If somebody died tomorrow, you'd only have eight.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, except that Mitch McConnell would completely change his mind and rush through the most conservative judge they could find. Let's face it, we're not talking about someone with any intellectual consistency here.
Yeah.
Can I just add in, though, that the best thing I've seen helping the Democrats are the third-party advertising juggernauts that are pumping out stuff on social media daily, whether it's the Lincoln Project or any of these other former Republicans, anti-Trumpers. Their media game and their attack ads are so far above anything the Democrats could put together. It gives me some kind of hope. I mean, no one can hurt you like family.
I get the feeling those ads are for an audience of one. They're only trying to create a reaction from Trump. And I don't know how many minds they change.
We need to move on. And we can't talk about the election. Specifically, what really interests me about this topic was, yes, it's election-esque, but it's not necessarily about that. But the body of the Supreme Court isn't this necessarily partisan football, the way everything in American society has become. And I thought that's really interesting. So on that note, we're going to move on and we're going to talk about Canada and its debt.
The reality is that we've faced an enormous shock to our system. We know that the federal government was in the best position to deliver support at scale and with speed. Our principle has been to get support to people quickly and simply, and we believe that we've been able to satisfy that goal. Now, we know also that the federal government, by taking on this role, by taking on the debt, it meant that Canadians, challenged Canadians, didn't have to take on nearly as much debt in their households, and that the corporate sector didn't need to take on nearly as much debt. We think it was the appropriate thing for the federal government to do in this time. You'll see that we are working to make sure that we manage our debt prudently. We've decided that we are going to extend the duration of the debt that we put out to the market, significant change in terms of how we manage that, so that we can ensure that we're able to manage that debt prudently on behalf of Canadians. As challenging as this situation is, we are in a position where the cost of our debt is lower than it's ever been before. In fact, our debt, the cost to service our debt, are actually going to be this year $4 billion less than we expected even a year ago. So that's, although challenging, that's obviously a better situation than we could have imagined. We think that raising taxes would be exactly the wrong response to dealing with this sort of challenge. We want to actually increase demand from people. We want to ensure that we put money into the economy, and that's why we've been making investments. So we believe that the focus on growth is a place that we should be focusing. We should be trying to grow our economy, which of course will grow jobs and create opportunities for the future.
Canadian federal debt load will hit $1.2 trillion in 2020-2021. This is according to the government's fiscal snapshot. Should Canadians be worried after Minister of Finance Bill Munro released this snapshot about the forthcoming budget deficits? You Canadians, Laura, are prudent, you're sensible, dare I say you're a little bit boring, and you are, you know, the one out of the Anglosphere countries that has not been running a massive budget deficit. Should Canadians be worried about Trudeau and his COVID largesse?
I think you have to look at the bigger picture, and most Canadians, if I don't subscribe to all of your stereotypes of us. However, I will capitulate to the one that we tend to be cautious when it comes to how we care for others, how we approach something like a pandemic. We have been very cautious with the pandemic. Thank goodness we flattened the curve across most of the country. We're seeing a couple hundred new cases a day versus the US at what, 17,000 a day or whatever it is. I mean, it is not, if you're 10 times our population, clearly we've handled this pandemic differently, better. And it's because as Canadians, we put aside the partisan rhetoric and all of the nonsense and the histrionics. We didn't politicize it. And we actually just tried to attack it. We haven't made every right decision. But part of Trudeau's largesse was to say, you know what, we're going to throw everything in the kitchen sink at this. Whatever we need, we're going to give people as many paychecks as they need to get through this. Basically, the message from day one was, we're in this together and we're not going to let anybody fall away. We are the very different message than we've seen, of course, in some other countries with more populist rhetoric and all the other nonsense. And so in Canada, yes, did Trudeau throw a whole lot of money at this, including, you know, we were giving out paychecks in Canada right out of the gate. In fact, people even got back pay they didn't even expect when they went for the federal supports, just because the idea being, we would rather have everyone healthy and stay home who needs to so that we can emerge from this thing. And so here's where I'm not worried about the debt. I mean, obviously, I don't love the debt and getting up to that or the deficit. But in Canada, we have one of the best ratings in the G7 in the world in terms of our economy.
But Laura, talking about that, though, one of the shots fired by the Conservatives has been that Canada is the only G7 country's had its credit rating marked down by one of the three American credit agencies.
One of the only two that had the AAA rating in the first place. I mean, so, but here's the whole point, is that you have to look at these things in terms of the broader context. Canada not only is, for the first time, beating the U.S. in terms of some innovation and competitive positioning in the world now, our footing. We have a great credit rating comparatively. We have a good debt to GDP ratio. And also, I hate to say this to my American friend, because I ache for you, but America's downfall is Canada's advantage, because we have many of the same capacities on a smaller scale. We have a much safer country in many ways. And we already saw before this happened, just with Trump's stupid immigration bans, that some of the Silicon Valley companies were looking at Canada as their new headquarters. So the more that America, unfortunately, is on its knees with this presidency and this pandemic, the less concerned Canadians are about our ability to be competitive and to make this money back. I just hope we don't tip into austerity measures. I hope we don't go into high inflation like in the 70s. I have some worries, Ryfield. I'm not Pollyannic here. But come on, would you rather be anywhere other than Canada in this situation at the moment?
Well, you make a very powerful and persuasive argument for Canada. You are waving that Canadian maple leaf flag. Emma, every world economy has had to respond to COVID. Just remind us how the average Brit is seeing the UK's government's response financially. Are they worried about the future, saying that we are mortgaging up the future and our grandchildren are going to have to pay for this? Or are they saying we absolutely need this right now?
It's so weird. We have two responses about the financial part of COVID, and they are almost exactly completely the opposite, but you get them from both sides. So you'll have people on the left going, oh my God, it's so awful that we're building up all this debt for our children. And people on the right going, it's totally okay to build up debt. That's what we've always done in a crisis. And those are weird arguments to be had from those different sides. You know, that's not normal in the way that we respond to things. You and I had a fascinating conversation the other day, you might remember, about debt. I have a very strong theory about debt, which is that there's a space that you get to as an entity whereby debt is good for you and you don't care about it. And that could be a state, it could be a corporation, it can be an individual. But there's also a state that you get to where you use debt as a weapon. And that's what happened in the 80s. That's what Thatcher did. She absolutely really likened the debts that we got into it as a country in the 70s to a household budget. Completely different. The way that debt responds to a household and the way that debt responds to a state is completely different. But politically, that was an incredibly strong message. Then we had the same thing in 2010s. The reason we had to have austerity was that the Labour government had crashed the economy by paying too much for the state, and we had to cut back. And again, it was that credit card bill debt that it was likened to, but it's completely different. So debt, we have, as individual political actors, we have very little understanding of what debt is, of how debt works, of how debt works for a state differently from how it works for us as individuals. So I'm in a lot of debt. I owe a mortgage, I have a credit card, blah, blah, blah. And that scares me and it keeps me up at night. So it's, of course, it's a scary word when you then say my country has a lot of debt. But my country has much more ability to pay that off, to work it, to push it out, to manage that debt than I do as an individual. But it's a really good way of stopping us from state spending.
Same question to you, Mr. Jarrett. Many people, but I added with the caveat that many people were surprised with the speed of the Trump administration's response to COVID. The fact that they decided very quickly they were going to give a sum of money to each individual in a household, but then subsequently, especially the Democrats within Congress are saying the federal government should go much further with its support for the US economy going forward. Now, considering that America has record levels of debt, how is that playing out politically in the US in terms of, is it just quite simply, if you're a Democrat, you think the government should spend more and Republicans say that we've spent too much? Or are there kind of like, you know, centrist independents who are also in either camp? Just give us a snapshot of how this debate to do with debt, COVID, and the financial ramifications of it post are playing out in the US.
I assume that there are centrists. I don't think that they get a lot of press. I think the partisan divide is so profound that there are two arguments that get made over and over again in different variations. And they're made by the usual suspects. I mean, I agree with the Democrats. I think we should be spending as well, maybe not as much as we can, but certainly one of the ways that you survive a moment like this is by injecting money into the economy. And it pays off in the long run, and it increases the capacity to pay back that debt. To what degree this is even being talked about or thought about outside of relatively rarefied circles, I can't tell you. I haven't heard anyone in my personal life mention debt or government spending beyond a general delight in getting money from the government. I think that there are so many things going on that that's an issue which is really backburnered. And, you know, realistically speaking, the way that America has interacted with money, and when I say America, I mean the federal government, has been so all over the place that I don't think there is a huge amount of people in the electorate who have any idea what any of it means if it's not a really direct thing, like now you're getting a check or now your unemployment benefits are way higher than they ever would have been. I haven't heard anyone mention it in personal conversation.
One of the things that I think is so counterintuitive and frustrating to watch with what's happening in the US is that for as much as, you know, Trump has the rhetoric about getting America back open, and Jared said it'd be rocking and rolling by July, we're 12 days in and it is clearly not, the sooner that they take the pandemic seriously and get a grip on it, the sooner they get to reemerge with some sort of competitiveness on the global stage. I mean, right now an American passport is you know, persona non grata. People don't want Americans coming into their countries. They're not going to want to deal with American businesses. I mean, they're putting themselves at such risk by delaying and making this so much more inflamed for the world. And so I just look at it and I think, you know, you're right. During a crisis, you throw money at it. You try to get back on your feet as soon as possible to work that back off. And I think that's why most people don't really care about debt. We're not talking about about debt. We're talking about how do we just get through the next month, the next 3 months, right? But the longer that America drags this out for themselves, the harder it's going to be to come back. And I fear having debt being used as a weapon for austerity, like Thatcher did. Here in Canada, we're already talking about that, saying, is this a chance for a universal basic income? Is this a chance to put in safeguards so that we do not careen over into that horrible space where people start to lose the very supports that have, I think in a large case with Canada at least, there's a reason why we have more access to COVID testing and to good COVID care, because we don't hesitate to go to the hospital. You know, it's not a calculation for us, right? We pay our taxes and we go to the hospital.
Laura, I was surprised that there were so many articles basically about what she had actually said this week. Is it quite simply the fact that this has come up, has been an issue in Canada because it's symbolically $1 trillion? It's a case of you tripped over a figure, people have just gone, and some people have just gone, type of thing, considering how bad your debt ratio was in the mid-90s and Canada was compared to a third world country in terms of its GDP to debt ratio. And then you got it all the way back down to a surplus quite recently. Is it just a case of it is $1 trillion and it's just a symbolic figure?
That's a couple of things. I mean, one, I'll give credit to Paul Martin. He was a Liberal finance minister. Some would argue maybe one of the, not a great prime minister. He didn't kind of have the alpha, but he did give a sort of austerity, kind of in a slow moving way, enough so that we buttressed ourselves and were able to weather the financial crisis of 2008 better than others because of that. And yes, we were in a position where Trudeau had a surprise budget surplus, right? And so people in Canada, we are in a very good footing. Now, why is it such a big deal, Royfield? Because it's really, if you look at what's happening in Canada, I mean, the two big stories this week are Trudeau is entitled and is too close to a charity. And he always is like Icarus. As soon as his numbers are super high, he flies too close to the sun, forgets he's a public servant and ends up falling back down. He did it with SNC-Lavalin during the election. I mean, not a huge scandal compared to what we're seeing in the United States, for instance, right? And our COVID numbers, thankfully, are much, much, much better. So is there a conversation we should be having around debt and our spending? And I mean, there was actually an assassination attempt on Trudeau this past week. I don't know if you guys are aware of it, but because a lot of the discussion was that the parliament has not been meeting as frequently because of COVID protections and all the rest of it, there was some rhetoric on the far right that he was a dictator. And someone wrote a manifesto, drove thousands of miles and tried to drive into his and kill him. He was unsuccessful. The individual clearly had some serious issues. But, you know, there is a roiling against Trudeau, and he does do some things wrong. There's no doubt about it. I'm not a Trudeau partisan by any means. But comparatively to what we're seeing in other places around the world, Royfield, I think in Canada, we're having the discussion around the $1 trillion debt because kind of everything else is going pretty well. You know what I mean? Like, you know, we have the capacity to argue around the nuances of debt to GDP because we are not literally trying to figure out how we're going to not triage people at the ER, right? When they come in to see what they do.
Because as I say, debt is not a problem.
And then we have the capacity to have this conversation. And I mean that seriously. You know, when we...
No, you're quite right. I did not know there'd been a threat on Trudeau's life. That's quite scary.
Yeah, and
I did know, and I'd forgotten because it was such a quirky thing and whatever that happened and stuff. I did, when you brought it up, I did remember. However, just what last note on this, and I think this is where this kind of unifies us all in this conversation.
We need someone more conservative than me at some point to tell me that debt's a bad thing because it's
not. one second. Let's just deal with today right now in this. Right. Have we got to a place where literally governments do print money? Are countries too big to fail? Within reason, can global economies, so we're not talking about, dare I say, the land of my parents' birth, Jamaica, but we are talking about Canada. We are talking with all its oil. We are talking about the United Kingdom, what, fifth biggest economy in the world. You know, America, the first biggest. Are they just too big to fail? So can they, in effect, print money and always get the debts paid and always be able to borrow within reason? Is this a new economic paradigm that it doesn't really matter where you are in the economic cycle, whether you're in relative boom or relative bust, you can always put rocket fuel under the economy in boom times by spending more, and when it's in bust time, you need to spend more to get out of that. Money markets.
Keynesian.
What was that, Emma?
You're such a Keynesian.
Macroeconomics, I love it.
but it's a serious point, right?
It's a very good point. And the truth is, we don't know. We don't know if the states that we have are the states that we'll have in 100 years. And if what makes those states fail will be economic or political. And those are two different things. They're often conflated, but they are two different things.
Absolutely. The French Revolution came about because the French government was bankrupt. It wasn't just because they did terrible things to the French peasants. They were bankrupt.
Yeah.
That's what they actually did for them. And arguably, the American Revolution is fundamentally all about...
No taxation without representation. That's an economic argument, not a political one.
It's totally.
May I just add this, just generally as a vague student of history, is that to ever assume that we are in a position where too great to fail, I think is a flawed concept. So
I get very, very, very angry with the phrase late capitalism. And the reason I get angry with that is not because I'm a capitalist, it's the opposite. I'm a socialist. But the idea that late capitalism, i.e. we are in the last stages of capitalism, is extraordinarily arrogant on the part of people who don't believe in capitalism.
Gerrit, where are we in the economic cycle of capitalism? Are we...
I don't know that we're in the late phase.
Maybe we're just at the start of capitalism, Gerrit. What do you reckon?
Yeah, I think Emma's right. I think it's impossible to know that you're at the end of something until it's ended.
Right.
Who knows? I think your original question gets to something that's terrifying, right? At the heart of it, which is, how does money work? And there are people who know how money works in sort of broad abstract details. There are people who know how money works in specific details, but we do live in a moment where I think every major currency, if not every currency in the world, is a fiat currency. And that is essentially the fundamental basis of that is fundamentally an agreement about the ordering of value. That agreement could break. There's no guarantee that that's not the case. And it can break from, in a globalized economy, it can break from external things, it can break from internal things. I don't know, I don't think anyone, I mean, I think people have broad ideas about how a functioning economy works. I think people have broad ideas about how an economy can collapse, but fundamentally there is a mystery at the heart of it, which actually dominates all our lives.
Absolutely. And I think the current mystery, one of the key current mysteries at the moment is, how much debt can a sovereign nation carry?
Yeah.
Because if you'd have said to an American in the 1970s that this level of debt that the United States is carrying to the Chinese government and Chinese bondholders, they'd have said impossible. So we are expounding our levels of tolerance to do with debt, and money markets seem to keep going with it. But anyway, this is maybe a conversation for another podcast. Maybe Planet Money or the Economy should really be weighing in here. We're only humble political pundits. So on that note,
Royfield,
go on, Emma.
When do you reckon that that the UK, the British government, paid off the debt that it had to incur to pay the slavery slave owners?
This was in the last 5 years. It was very recently.
Yeah. Yes.
So in 1832, the British Empire abolished slavery and only finished and decided, rightly or wrongly, to compensate the slaveholders. It was one of the ways of getting them to agree to them giving, and they only paid it off in the last 5 years.
2015. It's extraordinary, isn't it? So it turns out that's not that big a deal.
I just have to add one thing. I want to extrapolate on the terror thought that our American panelists just shared. One of the things that a researcher found in the U.S. recently, I saw him talking on a program, was that when there's a natural crisis, right, something like a hurricane, people come together, they build together. When there is a biological pandemic type crisis, it goes to our base survival instincts and we actually tend to rip apart. We tend to become much more, if you will, in a sense, miserly, much more protective of our own survival. And so I think to have a conversation about macroeconomics and too big to fail and the nuances around the mysteries of money and all of that, we can't do it without saying we are in a once in 100th century situation here. And there are relationships that make that mystical money thing work globally, right? People believe in each other's power. They have these different trade agreements. Everybody props everybody else up. And who do we want to have the big piggy banks? And how do we want that to work? And what my concern is that those sometimes explicit, sometimes secretive arrangements in the global money markets, they are Laura, possibly fractured right. by the weight of this pandemic.
But the question and so, isn't... how do we speak to people who disagree with us, but more, how do we change their minds? Because we think we're right, surely. I mean, you've got to start from a position where you think you're right.
Especially as a pundit, well, it's
you know
weird.
What? Because we're absolutely running out of time here. So we're going to have to hold that thought and quickly, let's insert a little bit of audio and then come back with questions about leadership in the UK.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
The honor and the privilege of my life.
He became leader in lockdown. And since then, Keir Starmer's been busy, not just pulling pints and clapping for carers, but wrestling control of his party.
I made my decision in relation to Rebecca Long Bailey yesterday and put out my statement, and I stand by that.
Piling pressure on Boris Johnson.
The Prime Minister, typically flippant, simply said it's not true.
And seeing his poll ratings rise.
I think the public view generally Keir Starmer as somebody that's a bit dull but very competent, and I can actually think of worse things for an opposition leader to be. I mean, Starmer has proven himself to be fairly sort of forensic and at Prime Minister's question time, and certainly has been doing what many feel an opposition should be doing at a time of national crisis.
A crisis calls for competence, and in the era of COVID-19, Keir Starmer's big achievement has been pinning the PM down on detail, with largely positive results.
The UK was slow into lockdown, slow on testing, slow on tracing.
His sacking of left-wing leadership rival Rebecca Long Bailey in an anti-Semitism row underlined his ruthlessness, and he's carefully negotiated sensitive issues like Black Lives Matter.
According to UK polls, Keir Starmer, the leader of the opposition, is competent, likeable and decisive. Have our views on leadership changed because of the COVID pandemic? Over to you, Emma.
Yeah, maybe. I think we were looking for a bit of shake up the world for the last few years. The Brexit vote felt very like that. Trump felt very like that. Boris Johnson felt very like that. But now, like, an actual terrible, terrible thing is happening and there are no grown-ups in charge. And we're feeling that. And I think that that lack of grown-ups in charge is being felt. That doesn't yet mean that anyone believes that the Labour Party is full of grown-ups, because we took a long time convincing them that we weren't. So it will be a long time to convince them that we are. So I don't know that the answer yet is, therefore, we need the Labour Party. But certainly the question is, who are the grown-ups? Where are they? We need them.
Jared, very obviously, your president came along with a distinctly different style to just about every other president, with the possible exception of Andrew Jackson that had been before him. Is there going to be...
Big block of cheese.
Yes, well done. Is there going to be... Not only, let's hope there's going to be a Biden victory in November, but do you think that COVID has exposed populism and bluster for what it is, basically, you know, an empty shirt? You know, that people have said, we do need to rely on science. We do need experts. We do need to be considered. We do need to be measured in actually what we say. We can't just think something and make it some level of reality. Will there be a sea change in American politics, not just because Trump is gone, but also because America has done so badly in the COVID emergency?
I think that is a question that is really hard to answer. If I was speaking from a hopeful position, I would say yes. Is the hopeful position the realistic one? That's a big question. I can't tell how this is playing in the US. I think Trump is part of a bigger problem, which is the complete crumbling of institutional authority. Does that mean that at some point there is a period of institutional rebuilding and the reassertion of institutional authority? It certainly could. Is that going to happen with a potential Biden victory? I don't know. And also, does that crumbling of institutional authority actually affect Trump? I mean, if you look at the polling right now, the answer would seem to be yes. But as I think Laura said earlier in this, we all learned our lesson in 2016, right? And Trump has this quality, which is really weird, which is he is someone who, if amongst other things, got into that office essentially as an agent of that institutional crumbling, right? So my fear with all of this is that it's actually just on brand.
It is, I agree. And I remember the day after the election, my comment at the time was that America was feeling ill. There was a lot of ills in the country at the time. They wanted the experimental drug treatment. They didn't want the tried true course that Hillary represented. They wanted, and it was even Reince Priebus said, you know, they're going to launch a Molotov cocktail at the White House at Washington. Well done, you know, achieved.
Yeah.
And all of this chaos and all of this outrage and everything else. I mean, it's a fire hose of outrage. It's always worked for Trump. Nothing can stick because there's too much. We're all just treading water exhausted every day, just trying to figure out what is going on. That has worked for him. He kind of floods the zone with bullshit. He floods the zone with outrage, and people are just so tired. Now, the only thing that is giving me a sense that maybe this time, truly this time, is because, and this is the only thing, and with the caveat up until the last minute on that fateful day in November that it could go to Trump again, is that I think the headwinds of COVID and the racial injustice in the United States, I think so many people are so involved in Black Lives Matter and care so deeply about having equality come to your country. And Canada has terrible issues with racial inequality as well, how we treat our Indigenous. I'm not suggesting that we're somehow better. But so many Americans, I feel like, are galvanized by that issue and are feeling real pain from COVID, that I think that it might just make it bigger than just whatever Trump can do in terms of his political theater. It might just be too resonant this time, and people will come out and vote in mass to get rid of him.
I think what's happened under Trump is really interesting, because what's happened is the exposure of the long-term project of completely decimating, completely destroying the public space. And that's been a long-term project of the right wing, but they kind of hid it. And Trump has exposed it because he's completely on board with it. So now we're just seeing so much of what's not there in terms of the public sphere anymore.
Well, it's a complete destroying of the public space. One second, it's a complete destroying of the public space, as long as you don't touch the police. And you don't touch...
Don't touch police and don't touch some random statue that was put up 200 years after the actual Civil War.
But, okay, we're talking about Britain here, and we've drifted off to Trump. We're going to drag it back. Though there are obviously universal themes to do with leadership, which is the reason why I posed the question. Emma, according to a Britain Thinks poll, 12% of Britons want to return to the old normal after COVID-19 has been defeated. So
yeah, they're not wrong. The old normal was crap. It was crap for most people.
And that was austerity, and that was divisiveness in terms of UK politics, etc. So has austerity had its day? Which some in my brain anyway links back to that last question about
austerity never should have had a day at all. Austerity was a terrible response to
are we truly at a pivot point in UK politics where we can have a kind of fairer society? And I don't want to be a cuddly socialist about this, but I'm a socialist, and maybe I've got a few pounds, so I'm a bit cuddly right now. But like,
socialist. Me and you, babe, me and you.
which is going to lead, and to have that kind of fairer, gentler society, does that mean that we also need a new, more gentle leadership style, which Keir Starmer seems to be personifying?
Melly is trying to show us a thing, and I can't tell what it is.
I can't see it either.
It looks very much like the Scottish flag, I think.
Melly, unmute your microphone, and I will say to the podcast listeners, I did say this at the very start of the show, podcast listeners. Melly, unmute yourself, it's fine.
Yeah, you tell us what your flag is.
Yeah, you've got to tell us what you're waving. So I'll say to the podcast listeners that this is an experiment, as we said at the start, and we are actually on Zoom, and we do actually have an audience of people on Facebook, but we have one on Zoom. And one of the great things about that is that they can automatically ask the question.
That's not what this podcast is about.
Melly, you were waving something. So what were you waving?
I was trying to show the Scottish flag, because you're talking about the UK and the governments are devolved.
You're completely right, Melly. And
my little marker wouldn't let me do enough for you. I'll mute myself again, Roy Field. I've made the point.
Okay,
no, thank you. Nelly is completely right, because Scotland has never voted for a devolutionary government. It's never voted for an austerity government. It voted for first very Labour and then very SNP, but both coming from the left in terms of economics. And it is very unfair to Scotland that they get the UK's economic...
But then, couldn't I say it's really
unfair? I don't want to lose you. Don't go. I'm sorry, May. You may disagree with me on this, but I don't want to lose you.
But these...
Thank you. I'm just saying thank you.
The last time I looked, Scotland is a constituent part of the United Kingdom, just like California is a constituent part of the United States.
No, it's
just
not like, the same, Royfield. That's not
like
fair.
Manitoba is a constituent part of Canada, and Manitoba votes conservative, and there's a liberal prime minister. That's how nations are built up, by constituent parts. So
no, that's not fair, because we don't act as if we are one nation. We are a group of nations that work together.
Okay.
The nation of Scotland has their own very specific identity and a really important identity.
Emma, back to Keir Starmer. He's going to be the exemplar of this new COVID politics, where everybody wants to support the National Health Service. Everybody wants key workers to have a proper decent wage for a decent day's work. And is that going to be one of the key reasons why this Tory shower are going to lose the next election, because everybody's changed? I actually think, on a personal level, so many people I've spoken to, whether they are in Canada, whether they are in America or in the United Kingdom or even in Scotland, have actually said many positive things about lockdown. It's made us appreciate each other more. It's made us appreciate people who do crappy, dirty, low-paid jobs a whole lot more. It's made the very fact of being removed away from the grind, the day-to-day grind, has made many people realize how truly connected we all are. I don't want to be some kind of utopian hippie here and whatever, right?
That's exactly what you're being.
But I spoke to so many people, Jared. So many people said, lockdown. You're one of them. We spoke for 2 hours last week, and you said, I quite like lockdown.
No, that is a mischaracterization.
And it wasn't that you were rejecting humanity, but you said time, space, quiet. These are not necessarily bad things.
I'm a single woman, and I haven't had sex since March.
Well, if Keir Starmer can help you with that, Emma.
I'm not sure where Keir Starmer comes into that, but...
On that note, with me being somewhat of a 1960s hippie, Jared, completely...
Maybe 1970s feminist.
Saying that we didn't have the conversation that we had last week. And then
no, I agree with you.
Rated woman that needs a special cuddle, we should maybe go to takeaways of the week. It's that time where... We just remember that we are all part of a global society, a community, not of people, but of souls. And we kick back, and as we are sipping on maybe our glass of red, or smoking on something which is very legal in California but isn't in the UK.
It is in Canada,
thank you. We chill and we talk about something which has excited us, or made us reflect on the human nature in the last 7 days. So I'm coming over to you, Laura Babcock, over there in Hamilton, a city I know well. What's been your takeaway of the last 7 days?
Well, you know what? I am a proud 45 and usually in terrific health, but I went through a painful episode of shingles, or I think they call it adult chickenpox in the UK. And it reminded me, as I had my family having to care for me, really, because it was one of those things where it needed all hands on deck for pain control and whatnot, that in the end, to quote an American singer, Jewel, only kindness matters, right? When you're in a position where your health is actually your primary concern all day, just pain mitigation and wondering when you're going to come out the other side of something that painful, you start to put other things in perspective. And we had a conversation during the podcast today about, you know, whether or not there's a goodness coming out of this self-isolation or quarantine or having to be home. I can certainly tell you that it made me very appreciative that I had people who were living with me, who would care for me as I would for them, and that other things that we get stressed out about, because this is a stress-related episode, are not worth stressing about. Because, man, once you have your nerves break down on you out of stress, you realize that going forward in this pandemic, which may last years, we have to find ways to care for ourselves, to appreciate others, to look for peace and kindness, and live a gentler existence. And so that's my takeaway.
Now you sound like a 1960s hippie.
I have become one. I'm all about the Zen and the weed.
Lovely thoughts and sentiments. How about you, Emma? You've been rather feisty in this episode, and more power to you, and also remarkably honest.
Not feisty, Royfield.
Well, that's 5 months without. Come on.
Right? Oh, I'm so up for a fight.
What has been your takeaway in the last 7 days, Miss B?
So I tweeted earlier today that I love London. It was just one of those just random things that you just send out into Twitter. The mayor of London has responded to me saying, yes, it's the best city in the world. And he's completely right. And I just want to, my takeaway of the week is that I am so blessed to live in this incredible, incredible city. It's the greenest city. Yeah, I can walk around and there's never a time that I'm not going to be near a tree. I can walk around and there's never going to be a time that I'm not near an art gallery. That's why I love London. And it's okay to love London. I'm not snobby about people who don't live in London. And that's where I think a lot of the anti-London stuff comes
in. You Londoners, you're like, oh, you know, there isn't a world outside of the M25.
Yeah, no, that's bollocks. I love the rest of the UK. But it is perfectly okay to love
London. You might love it, but you don't think it's as good as London.
There is nowhere I think is better than London except possibly New York.
Of London, etc., etc.
You have your Birmingham, and you love it the way I love London, and that's okay for you.
I spent 25 years of my life in London, and I'm not anti-London. But the problem is with London, and I think from both sides...
Oh, we go to the problem with London now.
No. You know, I lived in London from 1994 to technically last year, right? I lived in West Central London, loved it.
Yeah, if you live in West London, to be fair, you've not seen the best of it.
I didn't know our takeaways were debatable, so I love this.
I just need to bring it back a bit, right? The thing is about London, it's a serious point now, from the UK perspective, and I say this all the time, but it's so true. If you want to make it in politics in the UK, where do you go? London. If you want to make it in fashion, in London, where do you go? You go to London. If you want to make it in software, where do you go? London. The answer to everything in the United Kingdom is London, right? And it's to the detriment, Amelia, you can stop shaking your head. And it's to the detriment of the rest of the UK's nations and regions. I'm bringing this back to you, Amelia, which is the reason why the Scots pushed for devolution. Because since 1945, there was an over-centralisation of the UK state. And the over-centralisation revolved around
I've just
London.
Unmuted myself, and you're going to never let me on a Zoom again. We are already devolved. We are devolved in our education, in our healthcare, and some of our benefits, particularly disability benefits.
Edinburgh Central, now in Scotland.
But go on, Melly.
Okay, I'll undo it. You can ban me in future, it's fine. What did you ask, Emma?
I said one of the problems with the way the your devolution happened is that it's gone very Edinburgh central rather than devolving to local areas.
No.
So you've got a lot of things that sucked up into Edinburgh.
No.
So your local government has even less powers than our local government.
I would disagree, because the things that are devolved, have you visited the Edinburgh camp?
I've been to Edinburgh and Glasgow. I have
a Glasgow has its own kind of political thing going on, which is a bit of a nightmare. I don't live there.
Glasgow has its own politics as well.
It involves anything.
It's supposed to be the uplifting bit of the show.
No, it is. No. Sorry, one of my children is then laughing at me because I'm arguing on Zoom.
I apologize for my mother writing.
Glasgow is the, it has a permanent art exhibition with a traffic cone on the
front. Just found another new best friend. Just found another new best friend. But listen, the one last thing I'd say.
Right? I'm pulling rank. It's my podcast. Pulling rank very nicely. Right, is in terms of the Shetland Islands and the Hebrides, right, they feel excluded from Stormont. They absolutely
Stormont,
do.
That's in Ireland.
Sorry, Stormont.
Right, but they feel very excluded from that kind of central beltway, economically and politically in Scotland. And you're nodding your head. So anyway, so let's move on. So London is wonderful because this is the bit of the show where
I love London, London's amazing, that's all I want to say.
What I like about Mid-Atlantic is because you've got people from Canada and America who to me are geographically kind of the same thing, so, but I'd be totally offended if
we love you for that.
Mary, Laura's going to go for you. All right. So now we need to come on to you, Jared. What's been your takeaway? You need to rescue us because I don't know what dark makes you go back in there.
Amazingly, I have something which no one can argue with. All of the controversy around the around the Civil War and the Confederate monuments reminded me that when I was like 16, I had read a novel called Lincoln's Dreams by Connie Willis, who's a science fiction writer. And I had remembered really, really, really liking it. But my taste when I was 16 was awful. So I was very, very dubious about going back to read it. But I did, and it's amazing. It's a truly incredible book that is not science fiction, despite it being published under science fiction trade dress. Because once you sort of, I mean, I don't know if it's still true, but certainly this thing was published back in 89. And that moment, if you were a science fiction writer once, you were a science fiction writer forever. But it's a completely plausible ghost story that may actually just be about two people having a mental breakdown. And the mechanism of the haunting is that a woman may or may not be having Robert E. Lee's dreams. It's phenomenal. I was really, really delighted to
read that. What'd
you say?
That sounds amazing. I have to read that.
Yeah, it is such an incredibly good book. And I think her later work was much more popular because it was more genre. So it's been, and she's an astonishing writer. She's probably the best writer in American science fiction, period, ever. But this was like this little gem that I just remembered and reread. And like, as a writer in this moment, you spend a lot of time wondering if there is any validity to what you're doing. And then occasionally you'll come across something and be like, oh God, yeah, right. Novels can have actual power. This can really someone can really do this, and to find it in a place where one was not expecting it was really the highlight of the week. You know, I read it in a day. It's phenomenal.
Wow.
How wonderful. How wonderful to find something that you'd already loved and find new value in it.
That's yeah. So. And I mean, I was a complete idiot when I was 16, so I was very dubious about this thing.
Well, we can't be contentious about that. They're so beautifully put. And it sounds so incredibly clever. What an amazing setup. What's been my takeaway of the last 7 days? Truth be known, when I always ask about takeaways of the week, I've never actually thought about it until I actually asked the question, which is absolutely a dreadful admission, but it's a truthful one. I'm going to say that mothers. There you go. I'm being a big shout out for mothers. My mum, who's actually sneaked in the room since we've recorded this, if you heard a little creak off mic, it's because my mum tried to open the door, see if it was all right for her to come in, and had to turn round and go, no, right? And then she went round, all the way around the other side of the house and came in through the front. Mothers are wonderful. And I don't think, obviously, mothers have a special place in society, but I think they should be elevated just that little bit more. My mum went to the doctors this week, and my mum is incredibly health conscious. She's 72. She won't thank you for saying that, but she doesn't listen to this podcast, so it's fine. She's 72.
But she's in the room with you, Royfield, right?
She's now gone. She's got what she wanted and she's snuck out. She does yoga. She's embracing new ideas. She's now become a vegetarian in the last 2 weeks, and she wants to be a vegan. There's a real sense with my mum, but I'm extending this out to mothers anyway, that only do they, you know, have they given birth to you, have they, you know, brought you up, but also that my mom still wants to learn. She still wants to do new things, and she wants to share that with people. And I think I see my friend Amy, who's a new mom, and the love and the care that she has looking after her 16 month old baby, and how tired she gets, and how sometimes she just feels like there isn't time for her. I just go, what a job. You know, I've got 3 kids, but I'm a dad. It is a slightly more abstract role. It just is. You don't hold that human being within you. So it's always been not part of me, even though I love my kids and stuff. And I just think mothers, they're awesome. Everybody's got one, whether you know your mother or not. So big ups to mothers from me.
I wrote a piece recently about why I didn't want to be a mum. And it's a really hard decision, particularly as someone of my age, because I'm at the last point where I could ever choose that. And I'm right, but it's not a 100% decision. You know what I mean? It's, you know, there's a loss of me that's mourning the children I'm never going to have. And then I look at you and I look at the way that people behave with their own kids, and I'm brilliant. I'm a great auntie. Let's face it, I'm a My sister opened the internet bubble. I was like, and you're having the child for 2 days.
So may I just say, Royfield, the becoming a mother changed me a lot. I wasn't sure I wanted to have kids, but when I did, you know, you learn all kinds of things that you didn't think you could do or had capacity for. But I will tell you, one of the things that struck me as the best way to describe being a mother is to have your heart beating outside of your body. And so because my kids were in my body, now that they're outside of my body, my heart is literally physically, it feels like with them. I can hear them in the night. I always need to know physically where they are. It's a very different experience than my husband has with the kids, right?
I think you're exactly right, Laura. Part of the reason I didn't have kids is I would have been too overprotective.
Yeah, it's hard.
I would have been terrible, terrible mother.
I will write a book on all the mistakes I have made. I have a book on mothering mistakes. I do.
One day I'll be a great stepmother to someone's children.
This has been the end. We're drawing the veil down on our experiment of doing Mid-Atlantic. We're with a very special audience who, through bricks, that's some of the things that I said, unmuted herself and pushed herself into the argument.
Hey, Melly.
Thank you for your accent. I love it. I never hear Scottish accents like that.
Exactly what we want on Mid-Atlantic. Just to finish off the show, here is the normal drill. I say, Jared Kobeck, where can people find you on social media, sir?
Nowhere.
Quite right, too.
What are you working on at the moment?
A secret project that I'm not sure is actually going to get published. It's about Trump, but we'll see. Put it that way. One of the dangers of, like I was saying, actually, when I was talking about Connie Willis's book, is like, it's a weird moment to be a writer. Trump is like a black hole where anything you throw at it is crushed by gravity and forgotten 10 seconds later. So it's kind of it's a strange task to take on, but we'll see.
Well, good luck, and I'd like to read it.
Yeah.
Emma Burnell, what about you? Where can people find you on social media, and what are you working on?
I'm far too much on Twitter. I'm Emma Burnell underscore.
Laura.
Oh, yeah. You can find me, Laura Babcock, on Twitter, where I love watching Emma's tweets. That's been an experience on Twitter for a lot of different reasons. Laura Babcock on Facebook, LinkedIn, Instagram, and working as usual on my company and my shows.
Yeah. No, you should revel in your ignorance because it's awful.
This is where I say you can follow me on Twitter if you want to see badly formatted sentences which barely have any resemblance to being. And of course, for our Mid-Atlantic show, go on to our website, which is midatlanticshow.com, and you can go and post a voicemail message, which we then can refer to in a future show. I think we're going to keep doing these tests because we have a little audience on Facebook watching us live. I think it's really good to have audience participation. Just maybe not come in from Scotland though. Let's keep the Scots out of this. And that's been us. We'll see you all again in days time for another rip-roaring, barnstorming, controversial, but always an episode of Mid-Atlantic. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.